continue to foster public dialogue on, and a greater understanding of, ideas and issues of concern to Canadians. The evening will include a keynote address by computer scientist, composer, and author Jaron Lanier, a reading from Lee Miracle of her most recent work, and new music by Peter Hatch, performed by the Penderecki String Quartet and DJ Cyclist. Tickets are $20 for adults and $15 for students and seniors, and available online at riverrun.ca. The River Run Center is located at 35 Woolwich Street, a physically accessible location. For more information, visit guelphlecture.ca.
If you like roots and blues,
acoustic blues,
old blues,
new blues,
folk blues,
electric blues,
even crazy blues,
tune in Monday nights
from 7 to 9 p.m. for
Blues Around the Block with Mr. Coffee
or me, Jaybird, on
CFRU 93.3 FM,
Community Radio for University of Guelph. We'll be there.
Living on Less is a free 8-week workshop series focused on helping people to be more gentle on their wallets and on the environment. Each week, various expert speakers will present on a variety of topics, such as DIY eco-cleaning products, budgeting, homemade gift-giving, ways to save on energy around the home, and more. Each workshop features a hands-on element and is great for anyone who's struggling on a budget or is just interested in being more eco-friendly in their everyday lives. Workshops run every Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8:30 beginning October 22nd until December 10th at the North Riverside Community Center, located inside Waverly Drive Public School at 140 Waverly Drive, Guelph. Event is wheelchair accessible and childcare will be provided. All participants must register as space is limited. Email livingonlessguelph1@gmail.com to register and check out facebook.com/livingonlessguelph for a full list of workshops.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interests, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. We have organized, and we still do, and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA secret teams, and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands, Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way, until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese in Korea. And we had the Korean War, and a million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level, or the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan. Biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. Trying to summarize this third world war that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least minimum figure 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954, when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British, French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody, gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the Third World. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs. They don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And this is for the first time Back in the USSR is actually having a Halloween episode. For the first time Back in the USSR has fallen on Halloween. This is the, you know, on the day of Halloween. And I was kind of wondering what I should even do with regard to this show and given the content of the show, like what I actually could do, seeing that this you could say fortuitous event, I should say, has happened. And what I really decided to do is, you know, Halloween is really, you know, when we think about that, we think about, you know, fear and horror and all this, those kind of human emotions are very dominant, you know, at this time of year, surrounding like the kind of, you know, the kind of mentality, the kind of like when we think about Halloween. And I thought, what is the nature of are the really scary things in the world today? You know, the really horrific things in the world today that really do not come to mind when we think of, you know, what comes on in a horror movie or something like that. You know, I just played John Stockwell, who was a CIA insider who left the agency in the 1980s and basically told his story. He was, the highest ranking member of the CIA ever to go public. And he went public with all the horrific details of what the CIA was doing all around the world, like engaging in death squad terrorism, mass repression, you know, mass murder in country after country after country, from El Salvador to Guatemala to Indonesia, you know, to countries in Africa, to basically every continent on the planet. You know, the CIA has these operations, and they were engaging in the most horrific, unspeakable atrocities imaginable. You know, that took the lives of literally millions of people. And, you know, he, of course, was in a position to know. He was a commander, basically the director of the CIA secret war in Angola, which took the lives of upwards of 3 million people over the course of 3 decades. During which the CIA basically ran a proxy army called UNITA in Angola against and in support of, you know, in alliance with apartheid South Africa, waged war against the Angolan government and their allies, which, of course, Cuba was one of the countries that allied with the Angolan government in resisting, you could say, American imperialism and the CIA-backed forces in Southern Africa. And that was a long and very brutal war, which resulted from that, and resulted in the devastation of that country. And of course, if you want to add in like countries like that have also suffered this kind of devastation, like Vietnam and Guatemala and Nicaragua, Iraq, Syria, Libya, all these kind of countries, you know, the death toll is astounding. You know, far more important, far more horrific than anything that has been portrayed in a horror movie ever. You know, it doesn't matter how horrific your serial killer, your vampire, or like whatever, or your alien, or whatever else is portrayed in a horror movie. The CIA will beat it out millions upon millions of times over with the kind of atrocities they have committed. And of course, why do they perpetrate these kind of atrocities around the world? They do it in the name of empire, in keeping the world safe for the Fortune 500, you know, in furthering the profits of American corporations and the corporations of the capitalist class around the world as a whole. Now, I think I want to do a bit of a reading here tonight. This section I'm going to read is from a book called The Monstrous and the Dead, written by a British academic called Mark Neocluss, and he basically talks about the horrific nature of the capitalist system, you know, as outlined by Marx in the 19th century. And this is what he says at the beginning of his chapter on Marx, which is entitled The Political Economy of the Dead. He says this: towards the end of Volume 1 of Capital, Marx employs one of his usual dramatic and rhetorical devices. If money, he says, comes into the world with a congenital bloodstain on one cheek, Then capital comes dripping from head to toe from every pore with blood and dirt. The comment is a reminder of the extent to which the theme of blood and horror runs through the pages of Capital. According to Stanley Hyman, there are in Capital two forms of horror. The first concerns the bloody legislation against vagabondage, describing the way that agricultural peoples were driven from their homes, turned into vagabonds, and then whipped, branded, and tortured by laws grotesquely terrible into the discipline necessary for the wage system. The second concerns the horrors experienced by people in the colonies, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins. But there is, in fact, a third form of horror, the constant sucking of the blood of the Western working class by the bourgeois class. This form is nothing less than the horror of a property-owning class, which appears to be vampire-like in its desire and ability to suck the life out of the working class. Now think about that for a moment. You know, what Neo Clues is talking about and what Marx talked about is basically a horrific system of exploitation which dominates the planet right now and worms its way into every aspect of our lives. You know, our labor is exploited. We're forced to compete with one another for scarce jobs and scarce resources. You know, and our labor, you know, our blood, sweat, and toil is exploited to make profit for a tiny fraction of 1% of the population that gets rich off of us. It's an immensely parasitical relationship. And of course, this can be expanded worldwide into how the CIA and the US military and how, you know, and the imperialist powers of the world, you know, will devastate, you know, and wage war on whole countries and devastate entire societies in the name of securing profit for multinational corporations. You know, that happened most notoriously in the recent case of Iraq, but of course it's happened many, 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 many times before that and since then. You know, if we saw what happened in Libya in 2011, where an entire country basically was bombed back into the Stone Age, basically for the sake of securing profits for oil multinationals, you know, and Western banks and what have you. You know, this is the kind of world that we live in. This is the horrific nature of the world that we live in. It's something that we have to... This is a horror that we have to confront head on. If we want to bring about change in this world, if we want to work effectively to bring about change. And I've said that many times on this show. You know, and many people, of course, are despairing. They're very cynical about our prospects going forward because... In many cases, they don't know the heroic history of resistance that is out there and how people on every continent at every stage of history had fought back against that exploitation and won astounding victories. I mean, another thing, anniversary going on right about now is the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, which overthrew, you know, a capitalist system in Russia, which actually still had feudal elements at that point, and ushered in a new era, showed that working people could take control over their own lives, their own societies, their own workplaces, their own, you know, the systems of government. They could take control of their own lives. They could build society in their own image, not in the image of their exploiters. And that's huge. And that's happened in multiple countries. Happened in China, happened in Cuba, happened in even places like Mozambique, Angola, in Burkina Faso, it happened in Vietnam, it happened in, you know, in Laos, it happened like all over the place. You know, and this is the kind of, these are the examples many people do not know. Because the only thing they are told about socialism You know, it was basically this awful smear campaign which makes socialism look evil. So they don't hear these heroic stories of how people fought back and resisted and emerged victorious, you know, in the face of these horrific forces that dominate the world. And they don't understand that it's possible to fight back and win. Indeed, that's what we have to do. So I'm going to play a song right now. This is a song, actually, it's quite an obscure song. I wish more people knew about this, though, because once again, it does come out of that tradition of resistance against imperialism. In this case, this song comes out of Germany in 1950. It was sung by a man called Ernst Busch, a socialist, German socialist, in the DDR in East Germany. And this is a song against American imperialism. It in many ways echoes songs such as the one by Ali Primera, a Venezuelan singer called Yankee Go Home. This one is called Go Home Ami, Ami Go Home, you know, telling the American soldiers who are massing on the DDR's border, you know, during the Cold War, telling them to go home and stop menacing the people of this country, which is trying to declare independence from imperialism and build a socialist future. So without further ado, here's the song.
Was ist unser Leben wert, wenn allein regiert das Schwert und die ganze Welt zerfällt in toten Sand? Aber das wird nicht geschehen, denn wir wollen nicht untergehen und so rufen wir durch unser deutsches Land. Go home, Ami, Ami, go home, spalte für den Frieden dein Atom. Sag goodbye dem Vater rein, rühr nicht an sein Töchterlein. Lorelei, solang du singst, wird Deutschland sein.
Go home, Ami, Ami, go home. Spalte für den Frieden ein Atom. Sag goodbye dem Vater rein, rühr nicht an sein Töchterlein. Lorelei, solang du singst, wird Deutschland sein.
Clay und Cloy aus USA sind für die Etappe da. Sollen die German Boys verrecken in dem Sand? Noch sind hier die Waffen kalt, doch der Friede wird nicht alt, hält nicht jeder schützend über ihn die Hand. Go home, Ami, Ami, go home, spalte für den Frieden dein Atom. Sag goodbye dem Vater rein, rühr nicht an sein Töchterlein. Lorelei, solang du singst, wird Deutschland sein.
Go home, Ami, Ami, go home, spalte für den Frieden dein Atom. Sag goodbye dem Vater rein, rühr nicht an sein Töchterlein. Lorelei, solang du singst, wird Deutschland sein.
Ami, lern die Melodie von der Jungfrau Lorelei, die dort oben sitzt und kämmt ihr goldenes Haar. Wer den Kamm ihr bricht in zwei, bricht sich selbst das Knick dabei. Uralt ist das Märchen, traurig, aber wahr. Go home, Ami, Ami, go home. Lass in Ruhe den deutschen Strom. Denn für deinen Way of Life kriegst du uns ja doch nicht reif. Gruß von Lorchen, bon plaisir, der Kamm bleibt hier. Ami, hör auf guten Rat, bleib auf deinem Längengrad, denn dein Marschall bringt uns zu viel Kriegsgefahr. Auch der Frieden fordert Kampf, setz die Kessel unter Dampf, Anker hoch, das Schiff ahoi, der Kurs ist klar.
Go home, Ami, Ami, go home, spalte für den Frieden dein Atom. Sag mit deinem Vater rein, rühr dich an dein Töchterlein.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. your community station for over 30 years.
Spur Guelph is a new three-day festival of politics, arts, and ideas. From November 12th to 14th, be engaged and inspired by a series of keynotes, panel discussions, and readings featuring Jaron Lanier, Tim Lilburn, Lee Maracle, Tony Mestrovich, Nadia Mustapich, Wanda Nanabush, Philip Kevin Paul, Lee Smolin, Adrian Stimson, and music by Peter Hatch Digging Roots, DJ Cyclist, and the Penderecki String Quartet. Tickets are available at riverrun.ca. For more information, visit spurfestival.ca. Spur Guelph is a presentation of Music Guineas, the Aramasa Institute, the University of Guelph, and the Literary Review of Canada.
Hi, I'm Doug Blackwood. I've been hosting Seems Like Old Times for about 25 years now, featuring music and old radio memories from the 1930s to 50s. The show also focuses on issues and history-oriented subjects for older adults. If you know of something that would make a good topic of discussion or would like to hear a piece of music or old radio show repeated, why not email me at seemslikeoldtimes@cfru.ca. Seems Like Old Times, now on Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM.
On Friday, November 13th, at the River Run Center, the Guelph Lecture on Being Canadian will continue to foster public dialogue on and a greater understanding of ideas and issues of concern to Canadians. The evening will include a keynote address by computer scientist, composer, and author Jaron Lanier, a reading from Lee Maracle of her most recent work, and new music by Peter Hatch, performed by the Penderecki String Quartet and DJ Cyclist. Tickets are $20 for adults and $15 for students and seniors, and available online at riverrun.ca. The River Run Center is located at 35 Woolwich Street, a physically accessible location. For more information, visit guelphlecture.ca.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. And just expanding what I talked about before, just before the break, and of course we heard from Ernst Busch with "Go Home, Ami, Go Ami, Go Home," and of course I was talking about resistance to imperialism and resistance to capitalism and resistance to forms of systemic exploitation in general, and really the consciousness that victory can be won. You know, that we can emerge victorious, that we can beat back these horrific systems of exploitation in the world, that we can win. That is so crucial. That is so crucial in the world today, and really always has been. You know, the people who are being exploited need to have consciousness of themselves as an exploited class and have to develop solidarity, you know, and develop means of fighting back. You know, really, this is called working class consciousness. And I'm going to read to you something which I wrote. It actually begins with a quote from Vladimir Lenin from 1913. He says, "People have been the foolish victims of deception." He says, "People have always been the foolish victims of deception and self-deception in politics. And they always will be until they have learned to seek out the interests of some class or other behind all the moral, religious, political, and social phrases, declarations, and promises." You know, that's what he wrote in March 1913 in Three Sources and Three Component Parts of Marxism, one of the many writings which he wrote. And this is what I wrote. "A specter continues to haunt the world. The specter of communism. So many times pronounced dead, it returns like a vengeful ghost to menace the rich and the well-born, to shatter the tranquility of monarchs and presidents, to disturb the profiteering fanaticism of bankers and business moguls, and to drive liberal politicians into peals of denial and protestations of loyalty to God, country, and the profit motive. Above all, it is a phantom that embodies the fear of a capitalist class order that knows deep down that it is replaceable. That for all their power, all their riches, all their palaces, mansions, cathedrals, works of art, armies, bombs, weapons of mass destruction, and carefully crafted propaganda, Those who live off the labor of the masses are ultimately at the mercy of a god that they keep in chains, but whose power they cannot live without. The working class is, and always has been, the builder of civilization. Working people, past and present, have produced everything that has made human society possible, from the original technologies of agriculture and stone and metalworking, to the skyscrapers and spaceships of the modern world. Everything has been the product of proletarian labor power. The worker is the creator, the shaper, the builder, the foundation of everything. And yet, this god amongst men is treated as a beast of burden to be kicked and abused by the parasites that live off his labor. Chained and exploited, he builds palaces for his overlords while he himself is confined to poverty and drudgery. The godlike creator is thus treated as a slave and repeatedly told that he or she is fit for nothing else. This is the injustice that is at the root of class exploitation and class conflict, and the source of the bitter struggles of our time. Justice will only be possible when working people recognize their own awesome power as the class that is both the root and foundation of human progress. Therefore, the most critical task of the communist movement, from its origins to the present day, has been the building of the conviction amongst the exploited masses of the global working class that they are a force unto themselves, possessing their own distinct interests, moral values, and an international collective identity that defies frontiers. The interests of the proletariat, those who must sell their labor power in return for wages, are fundamentally at odds with the interest of the capitalist who lives off the labor power of others and the profits that this exploitative and parasitic relationship creates. Just as the interests of the slave were fundamentally opposed to the interests of the slave owner, and just as the interests of the peasant serf were fundamentally at odds with those of the feudal aristocracy. The proletarian is bound by his material conditions to oppose the exploitative power of his capitalist economic masters, who build their fortunes off of his misery and servitude. However, just because the working man or woman is materially bound to oppose the interests of the capitalist does not necessarily spur him or her to actively work for the overthrow of a class system that keeps working class people in bondage. From the rise of slavery in the early years of civilization to the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of the modern world, those who support the interests of the ruling elite have understood their dependence on the labor of the masses and have worked tirelessly to keep working people divided, weak, docile, indoctrinated, in conflict with one another, and unaware of their shared class interests in opposing the overlords who keep them in chains. The power elite have always sought an obedient workforce that cannot threaten the power and privilege of the ruling class. The naked display of power and cruelty by the slave-owning feudal or capitalist state in its suppression of slave uprisings, peasant revolts, and worker strikes has always been accompanied, concealed, and reinforced by a constant barrage of reactionary propaganda. Through the school, the church, the media, and every conceivable avenue of mass communication open to the considerable resources of the ruling class, working people are taught, from the time that they are small children, to see the world through the eyes of their political and economic class masters. The slave was taught to view himself as being naturally inferior to the free man, the peasant that he was bound to submit to his aristocratic overlords by the decree of God, and the proletarian that he must give himself over to the quote-unquote natural forces of the market. The inhabitants of third world slums are fed rags-to-riches fables, while unemployed first-world youths flock to career centers for instruction on how better to sell themselves as commodities on the job market. All are taught that a better life is only possible through continued submission to their masters. Thus, the creator is taught to revere and honor the parasites who rule him. Likewise, they are taught not to associate with working people of a different language, ethnicity, or religion. Such people are foreigners, infidels, heretics, aliens, outsiders, and godless communists, to give you only a tiny sample of the massive corpus of sectarian language that has traditionally been employed by rulers to keep working class people divided and at war with each other. Thus, the world of the working man is purposely kept blinkered, small, ignorant, and prejudiced. instead of blaming capitalism and capitalists for his misery, he is taught to blame Jews, Muslims, inner-city criminals, drug addicts, witches, pornography, feminists, communists, socialism, lack of faith, his own or that of others, lack of patriotism, laziness, immigrants, non-believers, and all manner of other generally politically weak groups of people who supposedly threaten the moral and political fabric of the nation. Thus, working men and women are instilled with false consciousness, kept divided, weak, and confused. Fundamentally, they do not see themselves as working people fighting against a common class enemy in the form of their capitalist exploiters. They do not see themselves as creators and builders, the foundation of civilization and the driving force behind human progress. Instead, they see themselves as loyal citizens, believers, subjects, employees, and followers, confined by frontiers, denominations, pay grades, and tax brackets, and firmly subordinated to their supposed betters. While members of the capitalist class plunder the world and its peoples, knowing no frontiers or boundaries in this era of globalization, the working class remains confined, mentally, spiritually, and often physically, to a specific place and time. They either do not recognize their real enemy, or their struggles are continually distracted and undermined by sectarian concerns and submissive attitudes. Working people are thus alienated from each other, which is precisely what the ruling class wants and always has wanted. The historical condition of women is perhaps the greatest example of the crime of class exploitation. Throughout history, women have been systemically denied control over their own lives and their own bodies. The rise of class society, represented in the words of Friedrich Engels as the historic defeat of the female sex, as the emergence of private property, slavery, and the economic and political relations of societies based on the exploitation of the many by the few, consigned women to the status of possessions and commodities, a non-human status they have struggled against for thousands of years in those areas of the world where civilization, quote-unquote, is the oldest. In a society where wealth and property become the supreme markers of power and authority, men, as controllers of wealth, exert total control over public and family life, in stark contrast to hunter-gatherer and early agricultural societies, where property was held in common and women exercised equal authority with men. Since the rise of slavery, the woman has been told again and again by the dominant institutions of state and class that she is inferior, immoral, less than human, and above all, that she is a possession. From the women of democratic Athens, who existed in unpaid and unrecognized domestic servitude while their husbands pioneered a political regime that in which only they could participate, to the hyper-sexualized women of the 21st century West, who for all their voting rights and hard-won gains must still struggle in a culture defined by the expectations of men, experiencing lesser wages in the workplace, in addition to unpaid domestic labor, women remain the marginalized victims of a class order that values the accumulation of property over human needs, and they continue to fundamentally exist as property in the context of the capitalist system. Class society is slavery for women, and so long as it exists, they will never know liberation or be able to exercise their full potential as human beings. Women are the super-exploited amongst the proletariat, who even more so than their male counterparts have a world to win, for the most downtrodden also have the most to gain from change. Working people everywhere must recognize the power that is in their hands as a collective force. Communists, as tireless fighters against the global system of capitalist class control, have long understood the working class unity, identity, coordination, and militancy are crucial in bringing an end to class exploitation. While deepening this exploitation to unimaginable degrees, capitalist globalization has also opened up new opportunities for working class mobilization on a hitherto impossible scale. Just as modern capitalism requires the resources of the internet to coordinate its vast archipelago of sweatshops in the global south, the resources of the internet also allow proletarian militants to communicate and coordinate their movements over vast distances. National frontiers, the very thing the capitalists had traditionally employed to keep working people isolated, are now crumbling into rubble as global capitalism's own urge for limitless expansion and profit sows the seeds of universal working class solidarity and thus the seeds of its own destruction. However, working people remain overwhelmingly chained ideologically to the worldview of their rulers. Beyond the facade of parliaments and congresses, we see a society run by boards of directors, trustees, governors, CEOs, and regents. The unelected, unaccountable power of the capitalist class is exercised in every institution, economic, cultural, academic, and spiritual, not to mention in every branch of government, the military, law enforcement, and the courts. What democracy that does exist is in a bourgeois nation is a cloak for capitalist class dictatorship in every area of society, in every aspect of life, publicly chartered and fully backed by the power of the state. When working people watch the news, they watch bourgeois news. When they go to school, they learn bourgeois values. And when they pray to a bourgeois god sold to them by bourgeois priests, pastors, imams, and swamis. They are exposed to the same divisive, sectarian, and disempowering rhetoric in every language, designed to keep to the same divisive, designed to keep them under control, so that they will not threaten the fundamental power structure of the capitalist system. We know who is preaching the sermon when Muslim working people butcher one another in the streets of the Middle East instead of challenging the economic power of the robber barons who control the Saudi Arabian oil fields, the Egyptian textile factories, or the Lebanese and Qatari banking cartels. The Soviet Union, Soviet Poland, and to a lesser extent communist China were undermined by the continued presence within their borders of religious creeds that extolled the virtues of bourgeois or even feudal forms of government and society. The Communist Party of China thus devolved into Confucian delusions of the harmonious society. The Communist Party of Poland was powerless to stop the concerted efforts of a reactionary Catholic Church to engineer the overthrow of socialism. And the Russian Orthodox Church, the spiritual bastion of Tsarist autocracy and feudal prejudice, enjoyed an enormous revival following the catastrophic collapse of the Soviet Union and continues to do all it can to reduce Russia to its former backwardness and ignorance. Theory is only useful insofar as it enhances our understanding of real-world conditions and effectively informs our response to them. This is what renders Marxism superior and enduring, for its explanatory power is rooted in the undeniable and daily realities of class conflict as it manifests itself in every aspect of modern society. Working people will never be free, and socialist societies will never be secure until the reactionary false consciousness instilled in the masses by countless generations of ruling class propaganda is smashed, discredited, and revealed for what it truly is. This can only be done when working people see the world through their own eyes, not the eyes of their rulers. Working people must know their enemy, know themselves, and fight for their own interests, fully conscious of their class and their power as the creators of civilization and of everything produced by it. Their freedom can only be secured through the total destruction of all systems of exploitation and the raising of a new proletarian socialist order upon the ruins. Through this militant awareness, they will come to understand it is their right, their duty, to inherit the earth.
El derecho de vivir, poeta Ho Chi Minh. Que golpea de Vietnam a toda la humanidad. Ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal. El derecho de vivir en paz. Indochina es el lugar. Más allá del ancho mar, donde revientan la flor, con genocidio y napalm, la luna es una explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir.
explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir en paz. Y ojo, nuestra canción que es fuego de puro amor, es palomo, palomar, olivo del olivar, es el canto universal, cadena que hará triunfar el derecho de vivir en paz. La, 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 es el canto universal, cadena que hará triunfar el derecho de vivir en paz, el derecho de vivir en paz.
Second time today, everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kevin. Back in the 80s, I used to hang around CFRU all the time. Anyone can volunteer here. Just email volunteer@cfru.ca or visit cfru.ca for more information.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objets d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll make it easier for you to get up and greet the day. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
Hey Griffins, my name is Tessa and I'm here on behalf of the Wellness Education Center and Guelph Center for Organic Farming. I'm here to let you all know that you no longer have to leave the campus to buy your fruit and veggies. An organic farmers market has come back to the University of Guelph campus. Brought to you by the Wellness Education Center and Guelph Center for Organic Farming, this market gives the University of Guelph students, staff, and faculty the opportunity to buy fresh local produce grown by our very own Griffins. We have everything from carrots, cabbage, tomatoes, and peppers to fresh herbs and garlic. We also have complimentary recipes available to make cooking a little easier. Need a pumpkin to decorate for Halloween? We've got your back. Not sure what a bitter melon is? Come by the market to find out. The market will be located across from the Richards Building, close to Bob's Dogs, a physically accessible location, every Thursday afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m. until mid-November. Hope to see you there.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And just before the break, of course, we heard from Victor Jara, who, with El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, which is a song in solidarity with the liberation struggle in Vietnam against the American invasion of that country. And of course, we also had Bruce Coburn with If I Had a Rocket Launcher, which is quite a defiant, let's say, anthem. Challenging. He wrote that in the 1980s, the time when these American-backed regimes, particularly in Central America, like in places like Guatemala and El Salvador, were like just basically engaging in death squad terrorism and outright genocide against their own people. You know, the full backing of the CIA and the American National Security State and all that. You know, that was basically his anthem calling out. You know, that horrific. You know, that horrific imperialism that he saw going on around the world. Now, to kind of round the show out, I'm going to play a somewhat different talk by Michael Parenti. I played some of his stuff last week, and I'm going to play some more of his stuff here tonight. Once again, he's a Italian-American author and scholar. And this particular talk, which he's going to give... which I'm going to play here, is one he played in the early 19... that he gave. It's a talk which he gave in the early 1990s, at the time when Oliver Stone's film JFK came out. And it just... There was a lot of controversy surrounding that film. Mainstream media really tried to boycott that film, interestingly enough, about the Kennedy assassination. Given the kind of allegations which came up over government involvement in the assassination in the film. And, you know, there was a lot of talk around that time. You know, there was a lot of, efforts by the American government effectively to suppress that story, by the media to suppress that story. And Michael Parenti basically tried to cut through all of the official spin and all of the conspiracy theories, you could say, which certainly have sprung up around the Kennedy assassination, and really cut to the heart of the matter, and reduce it to the fact, well, you know, it's absolutely conceivable for a organization for the American National Security State to assassinate an American politician, an American leader, if they viewed him as a threat to their own interests and the interests of the American empire and the capitalist class. This is not inconceivable at all. It's happened in other countries.